Let's get into Genesis chapter 6. We've talked about the size of the ark. It's about one and a half? I think it's about 1.5 football fields long, to use American terms, and 2 or 3 school buses wide, 3 or 4 stories high, two to four stories high. I don't remember exactly the details, but it's kind of like that. If you want to get a picture for how big this thing is, I heard somebody say a small aircraft carrier, probably a pretty small aircraft carrier. Yeah, I don't know how long aircraft carriers are, but I think they're more than a few football fields long. But yeah, it's not a teeny little tugboat. It's not, you know, you've seen the Precious Moments depictions of this little, you know, a bathtub toy with giraffe heads poking out of the top of it. It's not that. It's actually shaped more like a coffin. And it's got one window and it's got one door, but it's got a roof and it has you'll notice it has no rudder. That's important because Noah isn't supposed to steer the boat. In fact, he can't do anything but float around in his coffin. Anyways, let's keep going. Let's start with verse 16. He's finishing describing the depiction of the ark. Make a roof for the ark and finish it a cubit above and set the door in the ark on the side. Make it with a lower, second, and third deck. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Now, I'm emphasizing these specific words because I'm going to come back later because there's some arguments that these words do not mean what they specifically say. Everything on the earth shall die, verse 18, but I will establish my covenant with you and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And every living thing of all flesh you shall bring, 2 of every sort into the ark and keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of the birds according to their kinds, of the animals according to their kinds, of every creeping thing on the ground according to its kind. 2 of every sort shall come into you to keep them alive. And take with you every sort of food that is eaten and stored up. It shall serve as food for you and for them. Noah did this and all that God commanded them. All right. So he's got this big boat shaped like a coffin, basically. It has no rudder because Noah's not the one who's going to be steering. Noah's not, you know, steamboat captain. He's just going to be saved in the ark. Now, even though Noah's the one who's told to build the ark, Noah's not told to pilot the ark, to steer the ark, to be the captain of the ark. Noah is a passive recipient of God's protection through the ark. This is a big deal that this is not Noah saving himself. This is God saving Noah. And this comes up later in the New Testament when it's referenced, like 1 Peter 3:21, when it references the flood as this is the means by which God saved people. Chapter 7, then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. This verse, you are righteous before me in this generation, does not mean that Noah is perfect and without sin. But if you remember how bad the generation is, that all the thoughts and all the deeds of all the people were all evil continuously. It was very emphatic of how bad the people were. In contrast, Noah walked with God. That's the phrase that's used. It doesn't mean the same way that Enoch did, that he went to heaven without dying. But Noah walked with God in the sense that Noah was a believer. He was a follower of the way. He was a Christian, in so much as you can use that term back then. So he walked with God means that he was faithful. God credited it to him as righteousness. Verse 2. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and the pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of birds of the heavens, also male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground. Let me read that again. Every living thing that I have made, I'll blot out from the face of the ground. And Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. You'll see a repetition of a couple of numbers here. 7 is important. 40 is important. 40, what other times in history can you think of where 40 is an important number? Usually it's a period of time. Yes.
In the wilderness.
40 years in the wilderness. The Israelites walked around 40 years. Yes.
Days before ascension.
That's a good one. What about Jesus? How long did Jesus spend in the wilderness? 40 days. So 40 days consistently seems to be this period of trial, this period where God puts people through a significant kind of challenging time, even before Ascension, because they're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with the Christian church between Easter and Ascension. Jesus died. He started appearing to people. They start figuring this stuff out. Lent is a period of 40 days. We do this 40-day thing a lot. So the Bible has all these periods of 40 days, 40 years. I heard somebody connect. There's a whole bunch of science. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of theology behind the numbers. I'm not going to really get into it because I don't understand it that well. Seven is also an important number. What connections can you make with seven? Where is seven used in the Bible? Can you? What was that? On the seventh day, God rested. Exactly. So you've got the 6 days of creation, the seventh day, God rested. Whether you're talking about creation or whether you're talking about Holy Week, Saturday, he rested in the tomb. Seven is often seen as the number of completion, whereas six is often seen as the number of, you know, that was the day when man was created. The sixth day, that's the day that Jesus died on the cross. Good Friday is the sixth day of the week. The seventh day of the week, it is finished, it is complete, it is resting. I've had some people suggest before that this is why the number of the beast is 666, because six represents man, three represents the Trinity, 666 is man trying to be God, whereas 777 would be God actually being God. You can play all kinds of fun games with numbers and stuff, but for the most part, just stick to what the Bible says, and a lot of times when you have a specific number, say, what other periods, what other times in Scripture is this number used? Is it something similar? Maybe there's a connection. It could just be a coincidence sometimes, though. That's okay, too. Okay, chapter 7, verse 6. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of the waters came upon the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of the clean animals and of the animals that are not clean and of the birds and of everything that creeps on the ground, two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah as God commanded Noah. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. Now, if you're singing the songs in Sunday school, a two by two, whatever, they come onto the ark, that's perfectly appropriate because God brings them on the ark in pairs, although it specifically says that he brings seven pairs of clean animals. You know why he brings them in pairs? Yeah, so they can have more animals afterwards. God creates, and this is all the way back from the beginning, is he creates a complementary relationship between man and wife and between animals as well, because God, this indicates that God has a desire for life to continue. Now, God could just snap his fingers and make more animals out of the earth like he did in Genesis chapter 1, but he specifically wants the cycle of life. He wants this generation of life to continue. So even in the midst of the flood, where he is going to be causing great death, he is bringing pairs of animals, the wives, the Noah's sons and his sons' wives. He's bringing pairs of animals and pairs of people because he wants life. God is a God of life. Even when death is necessary, life is still the primary thing that he's shooting for. All right, verse 11. Verse 6. Noah 600 years old when the flood of the waters came upon the earth, and Noah and his sons and the wife's sons, sons' wives went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood, of the clean animals, of the animals that are not clean, and of the birds, of everything that creeps on the ground, two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah, as God commanded Noah. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. So again, you've got this period of 7 days. You can connect that to the 7 days of creation, or the 6 days and the 1 day of rest. A lot of times, so I'll say the eighth day is also important. Basically, you have a period of time of 7 days, and after the seventh day, you'll have the eighth day is referred to sometimes. This is kind of a new life, a new existence. You've got all of creation, you've got the day of rest, and now you're starting something new. You've got after 7 days, now you're starting the flood. And you're going to see afterwards, I believe there's another period of 7 days, and then after that, basically Noah and his family come out of the ark and they start their life. Yes, sir?
Just occurred to me, this is first mention of clean and unclean animals, isn't it?
Clean and unclean, yeah, so this is... Yeah, so this is before the Levitical laws were given to the Israelites. So God had somehow already defined clean and unclean animals. There's a lot of things that we kind of learn a little bit after the fact. For example, Mankind is not eating animals at this point. Animals are eating each other, but mankind is not supposed to be eating any animals until God gives them permission after the ark. So they're supposed to be vegetarians. I don't know if they were. If they're fine with killing each other, they might be fine with killing animals as well. But yeah, the clean and unclean animals, this is already important even before the Levitical laws. Verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heaven were open, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So how long did the flood last?
40 days.
No. The rain fell for 40 days and 40 nights. But then the flood lasted. We'll get into that in a second. But yes, if you want to count from when the rain begins until when they get off the ark, it's longer than 40 days. So we'll get into that. But for 40 days and 40 nights, the rain was continually falling. There's three sources of water that are talked about here. It talks about the fountains of the great deep, the windows of heaven, and rain. So I think it talks about. Let me see if it talks about the firmament and that later on. Let me just get through this section before I start getting into a rabbit trail. Verse 12, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 13, on the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons, with them entered the ark, they and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature. They went onto the ark with Noah, two and two, of all the flesh in which there was a breath of life. And those that entered, male and female, of all flesh, went in as God commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. It's interesting. They didn't board the boat and head out on their cruise. The Lord shut him in. It's like being shut into a tomb or shut into a casket. It's entirely passive at this point. If you want to make connections to being buried with Christ in baptism, go ahead and make those connections. Verse 17, the flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the ark, or on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters, and the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep, and all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and livestock, beasts and all swarming creatures that swarm the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animal, creeping things and birds of the heavens, they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days.
Is that why we have so many fish?
Well, yeah, so the fish aren't counted in this. Noah did not bring the fish onto the ark. There was no need for that. But do you notice that there's an emphasis and there's a repetition? On one hand, this is Hebrew doing what Hebrew does. It's helical. Two by two, two by two, two by two, they came on. Every creature, every creeping thing, everything in whose nostrils was the breath of life, everyone, 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 the whole earth, everyone, everything, the whole earth, above the tallest mountains, everything. Is that clear? That's basically what the Bible is doing here. It is emphatically saying the entire earth, without question, the tallest mountains, higher than that by at least 15 cubits. The whole earth. And by the way, nothing survived. Nobody had these other little boats. They all died, except for the people in the ark. It is emphatically clear. It is crystal clear, which is funny, because in some theological circles, this is one of the most debated areas. Because they say, well, God didn't really flood the entire earth. That's absurd. He only flooded a localized area. Well, what in the text leads to that conclusion? Because it's easy to say, well, you know, God didn't really raise from the dead. He swooned and he was brought back from the... What in the text leads to that conclusion? That's the golden question. Please find for me, I would love to read it, anywhere in the text that suggests that this is a localized flood and God was just killing off a single people group, but the rest of the earth was populated with people and they were fine. Yes, ma'am.
When I taught the high school kids the apologetics book, one of the things they talk about is the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
And how it must have been created by the flood because the layers are not in order.
The layers are not in order. There's, yeah, so in terms of archaeological evidence for the flood, it abounds. There's all kinds of things that these fossils could only happen with a rapid burial of sediment and water. This thing could only form with pressure of how many tons and tons and tons of pressure from all of the water, from all of the layers, or the way that certain valleys or canyons are carved out must be from a rapid flooding and release of waters. There's archaeological and scientific evidence behind the flood. There's also, and I talked about this, I mentioned this with Garth last week, with cultures all around the world, there consistently is a flood narrative. Now, I'm not saying that they get it right, but at least the concept that there was a great flood, the Babylonians, Mesopotamians, it's all over the world. So there's every, which is exactly what you'd expect if this was a real event. So there's every indication that this was a for real, actual thing. Verse, or chapter 8. So the flood waters, yes, ma'am.
So I believe I've been told that up until this point, there was no rain.
Yes. Rain had not yet fallen on the earth. The water, the mist or the dew or whatever came up from the ground and that water. So one other thing that we have to consider is that the scientific function of the planet, the environment of the planet was significantly different than it is now. It talked about the firmament. We don't really have we got an ozone layer, but we don't have great waters in the sky being separated. One of the guys that I was listening to said that he got into the math of this, and he says in order to flood, he calculated the highest peak of the highest mountain, and who knows, the geography might have been different then. The highest peak of the highest mountain to flood above that basically would have to have a rainfall of something like 4 inches a minute or something like that. It would have to be so much water that you would be almost drowning by walking outside. Now, it talked about that it was already in a really humid state to the point where there didn't need to be rain in order for the plants to grow. There was just enough water in the air. So it talks about that. It talks about water from the firmament or water, you know, the water that's divided above. Not entirely sure how that works because we don't have that anymore. And then it also talks about rain falling. And then it also talks about the fountains of the deep. This is interesting. They've only recently kind of discovered that, hey, don't you know that the Bible's actually right about that? There are great underground pockets of water that exist. They can find them under the ocean. Sometimes they erupt with geysers and stuff like that. So there's every indication that God absolutely could have used water that was under the earth's crust and brought the water up, brought the water down, and brought the water from the rain. So if you have water coming from three different sources, it's entirely plausible that the entire earth could be flooded, a cataclysmic deluge. And that's exactly what happened. Now, is it a miracle that God did this? Can God bring together all kinds of forces of nature? Can God call down lightning strikes and cause tornadoes and earthquakes? Absolutely, he can do this. Could God have just said, let there be water, and water exists? That's also a possibility. But it's interesting that there seems to be indications that we have from archaeology that some of these things have been used. Yes, sir?
5 days.
Yeah. You've got 7 days. In addition to the 7 days that it takes for the water, the floods of the water to come upon the earth, you have 120 years or so of the ark being built. So sometimes you've got these depictions, and they're pretty gruesome depictions, where you've got the ark is on the mountain and people are clawing on the outside of the ark. It's like, where were you the last 120 years? Didn't you have somebody warning you to, you know? So there is sometimes this is used as an excuse to say, well, you know, God just surprised the entire world, just flooded them overnight, and nobody had any chance to repent. Or no, everybody was just so evil that they didn't care. And yeah, so this is something. It's interesting that it also, in verse 11, first of all, in the New Testament, this is referred back to as a historical event, just as such and such happened, this actually happened. But I also like that there's indicators that are placed in the text in the Hebrew. In verse 11, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the second month of the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep earth were. So it gives you a specific date when things happen. Now, it's really hard for us to calculate that date, but at least the indication here is this was a specific historical event that happened, if you're like, the second day of March 2025 or something like that. It's the text is clear that it wants to be read as a historical narrative, not as once upon a time in a land far, far away. I don't know where the land was. I don't know what the time was, the date was, that sort of thing. So this is, yeah, it's very important. These little details can get glossed over, but they tell us some pretty important things. All right. Everything died. Verse 7. Chapter 8. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over all the earth and the water subsided. Okay. When God remembers you, that's a really good thing. It's not God's like, oh, I left the stove on. Oh, that's right. I had people floating around in a box. Oh, man, I almost forgot. It's not that he forgot. When he remembers, it means he regards somebody with favor. God remembered them. Basically God loves them. This is an indication that God didn't forget about them, but God remembered them and he loves them. Hebrew's going to do this helical thing that Hebrew does where it says, there was a flood and the flood went away and then it starts going back and this is how it went away and it goes through the details in kind of different aspects. God made a wind blow over the earth and the water subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were closed and the rain from the heaven was restrained and the water receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. And in the seventh month of the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountain of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So this is giving you a detailed kind of chronological timeline of this happens. The waters start going down. The ark lands on top of Mount Ararat. The waters continue to go down. Then you can see the tops of the mountains. The waters continue to go down. Yes, sir?
The Bible tells us where mm-hmm. the ark rested.
Yes. That's, well, the Ark of the Covenant in any case. The Ark of the Covenant, we're completely unsure where it is. There's a couple of theories. Noah's Ark, there have been some suggestions that they figured out where it is.
Recently.
Yeah, this is archaeology.
The past couple weeks.
There were some, I didn't get to read about that. I remember reading a couple years ago that they found some formation on top of a mountain. They said, this could hypothetically be something.
I looked on ground scans mm-hmm. and it found platforms in what's described in the Bible.
Yeah. This is interesting. I'm going to look this up. But yeah, I remember reading a couple weeks ago that they found something indicating that they think that this is where the Ark is. So the Ark of the Covenant, I doubt, you know, Indiana Jones has it locked away. I doubt that one, people would find it, and two, if people found it, good things would happen. I think that even if God doesn't kill everybody who touches it, I think that people would start to worship it and turn it into an idol like they did with the bronze serpent. But in this case, yeah, there's indications, at least there have been indications so far that people think they know where the Ark is. And if they've done recently ground scans of it, this is exciting. Now, Christianity is not a religion of just dumb, what they call it, blind faith. Faith is when you trust in the things not seen, therefore all faith is blind. But Christianity is informed and Christianity is upheld by archaeological discoveries. Therefore, many archaeologists, they are operating under the assumption that the Bible is right, therefore let's dig in this place. Wow, we found these indications that King David was a real person, and King Josiah was a real person, and King Solomon was a real person. And look, we found Pilate's house, and look, we found Peter's house, and look, we found the tomb of Caiaphas. So a lot of these digs are basically confirming what we've already been saying in the Bible, and I think God does this on purpose. Because if he gave us all of the archaeological evidence right off the bat, we'd be like, what have you found lately? But God kind of drips it out every once in a while. Something will come out and they'll say, wow, that's exactly what the Bible said was. It's almost like the Bible's been proven right again and again. Okay, let me keep going. Verse 6, chapter 8, verse 6. We're in Genesis chapter 8, verse 6. At the end of the 40 days... there's your 40 again. Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot. Then she returned to him to the ark. So the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her back into the ark with him. And he waited another 7 days. And again, he set forth the dove from the ark. So here's your 7 days, and then the next day, the eighth day. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. In the 601st year, In the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from the earth, and Noah removed the covering from the ark, and look, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wives and your sons, and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you in all the flesh, all the birds, the animals, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. When you hear creeping things, you can think of reptiles and stuff too. That they may swarm on the earth, be fruitful, and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. So this is one other indication that there are not other animals living on the planet. I mean, I'm not talking about fish and whales and stuff like that. There were not other creeping there weren't horses in America that survived. This is all the animals that we have on the planet today are a result of the animals that were on the ark. Now, there could have been some that died before the flood, maybe. There's, you know, things get extinct all the time.
But if the dove came back with an olive branch,
yes.
Does that mean that there was...
There were plants, there's vegetation, yes. Now, the question is, there's some questions as to how long can vegetation survive submerged? One, God can preserve things miraculously. Two, we don't have to necessarily believe that all the water that covered the earth was all the same salinity as seawater. Because again, you've got rainwater, fountains of the deep, and you've got the waters of the firmament. So it could very well have been that just the plants were preserved on the earth. It doesn't really make a huge difference, but yeah, there were plants because olive trees don't really grow in a day. So remember, God killed every creature in whose nostrils was the breath of life. Does not include plants. Does not say that God flooded the earth to kill the plants. God flooded the earth to kill the animals and the people. Verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. You see here why he didn't just take two of every kind of animal? Because he was like, okay, well, let's make a sacrifice to God. Two unicorns, let's kill them. Oh, now we don't have unicorns anymore. We've got seven pairs of clean animals. This is so he can sacrifice some of them. Verse 21, and when the Lord smelled the pleasant aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So this is God's promise. This is God's promise that he makes to, not just to Noah, but also to the entire earth. Chapter 9, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth and every bird on the earth, upon everything that creeps on the ground and every fish of the sea. Into your hands they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with this life, for that is its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. So this is, God is giving a command. Again, he's saying, well, obviously you shouldn't murder people, but let me emphasize, don't murder people. He's also giving animals to be eaten. Verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Verse 7, and you... be fruitful and multiply. Team on the earth and multiply on it, because God likes life. Verse 8, then God said to Noah and his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring and with every living creature that is with you, the birds and the livestock and every beast of the earth that is with you. As many came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut out by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is a sign of the covenant that I make between you, between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I've set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring the clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and every living creature and all flesh. And the waters shall never again be a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it, and I will remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I've established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. You see, this is all. This is my problem with a local flood argument. This section right here. Because God establishes his covenant, his promise to never again flood the entire earth as he had done. If God had only flooded a certain portion of the earth, God would therefore be only promising not to flood anything ever, not to flood any sections of the earth. But as you can tell, we've had sections of the earth flooded before. There's floods all the time. There's not a worldwide flood again, which is exactly what God promised not to have again. But there are localized floods. So first of all, if God only flooded a localized area, then his promise is already broken to not flood a localized area again. Second of all, God's promise, his covenant, his blessing is with those animals and those people that were on the ark and their descendants. Which means if God only flooded a localized area and the rest of the earth wasn't flooded, the rest of the earth wasn't blessed. God did not make a covenant with the rest of the earth. So if there's other people, there's other civilizations, there's other animals, all of them are cursed. None of them have the blessing of Noah because none of them were on the ark. If there's a localized flood, there's a localized covenant. If there's a localized covenant, there's a localized blessing. Therefore, everything else is cursed. And that runs in conflict again with point number three, that he keeps saying all flesh, everybody who's in whose nostrils are the breath of life, the whole world, the highest mountain, all of the land. It could not possibly be more clear. And yet there's a persistent argument that it must be a localized flood. It must conform to this idea that they have of, well, it's just too much water. It's just too, it would have to be a miracle for God to flood the entire world. It's like, well, there you go. It's almost like that's exactly what it was. It was a miracle. Yes, ma'am. I'm perpetually frustrated with this concept that it's somehow the Bible versus science, as though the science, settled science, it's all settled. We have the science. We got to get the Bible is a book of facts, and science is another book of facts, and they conflict with each other, and we have to figure out which narrative is correct. It's completely, completely absurd, because science is a method, a means by which we gain information. It's not a list of facts. It is a way to observe and test and predict things. And what using the scientific process, the empirical process, tells us is that the things that are claimed in the Bible actually end up to be true. We actually, when we study archaeology, when we study anthropology, when we study the ancient dead, when we study ancient civilizations, when we study ancient formations, time and time and time again, they confirm what the Bible has already taught. Now, there's sometimes when we get information, we say, well, I don't know how to interpret this. Why is this fossil here? Why is this striation on the rock the way that it is? And we don't have information, but later on, maybe we figure it out, or maybe we never do. That's fine, we don't have the full picture, but we do regularly have that God confirms the things that he says happens in the Bible as historical. Let's see if there's any other. All right, so yes, it is very important. This is extremely important that the flood was over the entire earth, because it's extremely important that God's promise is over the entire earth. And I want to point out something else here that is often misunderstood. And I'm going to ask you a trick question, and I'm going to tell you it's a trick question. We'll see if you still get it wrong. Who is the rainbow for? To see the rainbow. Who is the primary person who's supposed to see the rainbow?
It's God's promise.
It's God's promise. It's for us to see. So God made it visible for us, but God says, when I see it too. So both of us. So it's both for us and for God. So it is a visible, because God could tie a ribbon on his finger and only he could see it and he could remember his promises. But the fact of the matter is he puts a rainbow in the sky so we can remember his promise. But specifically when he says, when I see the promise, I will remember, which means that it's all on him to remember. So even if we look at the sky and we're like, oh, that's a pretty rainbow, I wonder what it means, we don't know. God remembers. It's not about us fulfilling our end of the covenant. This is an entirely a one-sided covenant where God says, I will bless you and I will remember the covenant. I will remember the promise. Not that God is forgetting. Not, oh, that's right. I was about to flood the earth again. I promise not to do that. In the same way that he remembered Noah and the people on the ark, it's not that he was forgetting them, but that he continues to remember. He continues to love. He continues to have this promise and hold this promise. Let me see if I can end. I don't know if I can end this chapter in okay. We'll have to go back to Genesis chapter 9, verses 18 and following, because there's some stuff in there that needs to be gotten into that I can't get into in under a minute. But suffice it to say, there's a lot of death in Noah's flood, worldwide flood. But the ultimate point of all of this death and all the people who were drowned and all the animals that drowned, the ultimate point is life, is that God protects and keeps alive our ancestors. Every human being who's on the face of the planet now is related to Noah and his the eight people on the ark. Every animal that didn't survive the flood in the water, like whales and fish and stuff like that, they're all related to all the animals. So God's blessing is on all of y'all and all of the animals. So it's ultimately about life. Yes, lots of very evil, wicked people died. It's a tragedy that they had to die, but they did not repent. They had plenty of time to repent. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of just getting more and more evil and wicked. Then 120 years of Noah probably preaching them, by the way, y'all are going to die if you don't repent. But it's ultimately about life. Pairs of animals were brought onto the earth to create life. Be fruitful and multiply and cover the face of the earth is about life. And he protected the eight souls in the ark, eight souls in all. It was all about life. 1 Peter 3:21. This is why, if you look at our baptismal font, and many, not all, but many baptismal fonts, it has eight sides. It has eight sides on the baptismal font because eight people were saved in the ark. So we connect baptism to the ark in that way because the Bible does it. So anyways, Noah's flood is ultimately all about life, even though death had to be a consequence of sin. Life is the result for the believers. God saved Noah, saved the animals. It's a story about salvation, not about condemnation.